This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Erev Tov. Okay, so this is the moment where we all have to silence our cell phones. Great. And I'd like to welcome everybody here to the second lecture in our evening series on Jewish life, Halakha, and our changing reality. This week we're really excited to have Rabbi Shlomo Brody here, who runs the Overseas Fellows Program at the Tikva Institute. Shlomo Brody is a graduate of Harvard University, of Yeshivat HaRetzion. He holds smicha, rabbinic ordination, from the Israeli Harabanut HaRashit Yisrael. And probably many of you are familiar with his column in the Jerusalem Post, where he has penned the Ask the Rabbi column for many years. Columns which eventually seeded the way to his award-winning book, A Guide to the Complex Contemporary Halachic Debates. And in this regard, I think he really is a purveyor to the public of really understanding the process of halacha, the different factors which go into halacha, and is very much a contemporary expert in this area, which is why we invited him. He is also a personal friend, but this is why we invited him tonight, in order to share with us an understanding of how, when science changes or when we have outdated science, how does that affect halacha. Also, introducing Rabbi Brody, I just want to say that I'm delighted to hear that he's just recently submitted his doctorate. So that's a wonderful thing, and any of you who have doctorates know what a huge thing that is. So we're really, really delighted to have you here tonight, and we look forward to the lecture. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be here. Can you hear me in the back? Do I need a microphone? I'll use the mic. I had this trauma, unfortunately, from experience, where I was once speaking about 3 minutes into the lecture. Someone in the front row says, we can't hear you. And someone in the back row says, we can't hear you. And someone in the front row says, I can't, want to switch. Okay, so I'm always a little bit traumatized by that. I'll use the microphone for our occasion. So if Alex asked me to speak about changing knowledge and the science, particularly how it impacts halacha, but I want to start off with some stories about the issue of evolution, the theory of evolution, and how Judaism has responded to that, for simple reason, but I want to indicate that through three stories. When I was a university student at Harvard College, I had the privilege of taking a class in evolution with the well-known paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould. And so it's a big class, and they have these like small sections with TAs. And at some point, a few weeks into the class in evolution, the TA comes up to me and says to me, this must be a big deal for you, learning about evolution. So I was wearing kippah, but I just figured, it's the class of Stephen Jay Gould. So I'm like, yeah, Stephen Jay Gould is a big, big time, so that's really cool. And she said, no, I see you're...
I'm like, oh, yes, I'm religious. She says, so this must be a new concept for you. And I said to her, well, no, actually, no, this is not really a new concept for me. And I sort of gave her modern orthodoxy. I'm like, Al Rega Al Chat, my father's a professor of philosophy, blah, blah, blah. Like, we learned about evolution in our house. And she says to me, well, it's so fascinating because I grew up in a small town in Minnesota, very small rural area. And this was a totally forbidden topic. And only when I came to college did I hear about it. And of course, now she became a graduate student in the theory of evolution. So she was shocked that someone who was religious had no problem with thinking about the theory of evolution. Now, 10 years later, I was already a rabbi, and I was speaking at a synagogue in the Northeast in the United States, and I won't tell you where for obvious reasons momentarily. And I was talking about how to resolve the alleged conflict between evolution and the Torah. And I could tell no matter what I was going to say, someone was going to be very upset at me by the end of the lecture. And indeed, that is what happened. And so I was speaking for about 45 minutes. There's Marev. Afterwards, someone comes up to me, and he says to me, so you believe that the world can be billions of years old, and you're not a heretic for believing that? You're not an Apikoros? I said, yeah, that was the whole point of this year. That was exactly what I was trying to say. He said, well, why would you believe such a thing? I said, well, you know, there's a lot of evidence for the antiquity of the universe, like, you know, dinosaurs and fossils and whatnot. So he goes to me, well, what's a dinosaur? And I said to him, you're joking, right? He said, no, what's a dinosaur? So I said, well, you're here in New York. There's this big, large institute right by Central Park. It's called the Museum of Natural History. And if you make yourself down there, you'll see reconstructions of these large animals. And he says, huh. I said, huh. And that's how the conversation ended. And then a week later, I was speaking about the same topic in the University of Pennsylvania in the Hillel there. And it was a Shabbat afternoon, about 70, 80 people. Most of them looked like they were dressed for a Shabbat affair. And then 5 minutes into it, two young men walked in wearing like sweatpants, and it looked like they just come from the gym. And I figured it's a Hillel house. That's very good. I'm happy, of course, for all people to come hear me speak. And I gave the whole same, you know, spiel about how I think it's all compatible. And then the two young men come up to me after the shiur, and they say to me, Rabbi Brody, you have no idea how much you've inspired us in our faith. Now, I like to think of myself still as a young rabbi, but then I was a really young rabbi. I was like 26. And you know what it's like for a young rabbi, for someone to come up to him and say, you know, you've inspired us in our faith? So, you know, I'm going into Shemaim there, right there and then. I'm all happy. And they go on to say, because, you know, we're evangelical Christians. And we have struggled with this issue greatly. And we don't really have resources on campus to help us deal with it. And you really inspired us in our faith. So thank you very much. I didn't even know how to respond. I sort of muttered it out a little bit, Baruch Hashem, and then let it go. It was a fascinating moment for me, all these moments, for the following reason. I think most of us in the room, I'm looking around, I suspect most of us, when it comes to evolution and Judaism, feel very comfortable with it, right? We're not losing sleep over this issue. Or I lose sleep over the fact that people still lose sleep over the issue, right? But many of us have worked out for ourselves how to reconcile these two claims, both of the Torah and evolution. And I think for many of us, and certainly for me, the reason why it's so important is, you know, when I hear people for religious reasons alone who want to deny aspects of the theory of evolution, so I basically feel like that their goal is to say, I just want to be religious. And what about the search for truth? About the scientific truth? The historical truth? Well, if it clashes with religion, then what? I'm just going to let religion win. As opposed to saying, well, I think that religion is one of the mechanisms in my own personal search for truth. Right, so the question becomes, right, are you being religious, so to speak? Excuse me, are you trying to adopt certain theories so you can be religious? Or do you view your religious journey as a pathway for your own search for truth? Now, I certainly think of it in the latter manner. And therefore, when it comes to questions of science and religion, one of the reasons why I try to figure out how the two could be reconciled or work with each other is because I see both of them, each in their own way, as a way of developing part of the process for the search for truth. And there's many people have written about this. Rabbi Sacks has written about this. Alvin Plantinga has written about this and others. But when it comes to halacha, it gets a lot more complex. And this is what I want to show you tonight. Because when we think about evolution, what's at stake here is, you know, is the Bible true? Okay, well, that's a big issue. And I get why that's a big issue. But I have ways of reconciling that and dealing with it. Now, when it comes to halacha, and particularly cases of halacha that are based on certain scientific assumptions, and those scientific assumptions are no longer found to be true, well, what do you then do about the halacha? I'll give you a simple example. According to the rabbis and Talmudic sages, right, it is forbidden to eat meat and fish together. Why? Why is it forbidden to eat meat and fish together? It's dangerous. It's not exactly clear why it's dangerous, but they say it's dangerous. Now, we know today that that is not true, right? But, you know, there's a little bit of a halachic discussion, should we still keep that law? But by and large, you know, people keep that law, I think. And you know what? I don't really feel like I've lost out on life because of that. Right? Maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm missing out on something, right? Someone will correct me otherwise, but life's okay. Right? Now, there are other cases where sort of the science has been deemed outdated and halacha has changed in one form or another because of it. And it's an interesting question. Why sometimes do we say the halacha has changed? Why do we sometimes say the halacha has not changed? For example, in Talmudic medicine, when the rabbis give Talmudic advice about medicinal therapies, so already in the Gaonic time period, everyone said, oh, this is just outdated medicine. We don't have to care about it. I'll give you an example. The Gemara in Chulin said, eat fish for healthy reasons. Why? When should you eat fish? When the smell really just starts to emerge. That's not a good smell they're referring to, right? This is not good advice. Okay, right? Do not follow this. And already the Gonim said not to follow it. So it's an interesting question when we say, okay, outdated, when we say, no, it doesn't matter, the halacha is the same. But when it gets really interesting for me is when the question isn't just about outdated science or knowledge and the law, but when there's conflicting values, when there might be a good reason to very much say the law has to change here, or there might be a very good reason to say, even though we think the science is outdated, the halacha shouldn't change. And it becomes much more complex. And I want to give a few examples of this phenomenon tonight. There are many others, but a few examples which I hope will allow us to think through together this question about the alleged conflict between halacha and science, and Judaism and science in general, and particularly when it comes to law. So I have three examples I want to focus on. The first one relates to the Metzitza Bepeh controversy. Now, what can we say about Metzitza Bepeh? Well, this is what is Metzitza Bepeh? As you know, we do circumcision. Now, there are three stages the Gemara tells us, the Mishnah tells us, followed by the Gemara in Shabbat, Kuf Lama Gimel, of three stages of this ritual. We moalin, uporin, umotzitzin, right? That we do the circumcision, we pull back the foreskin, and then there's metzitza, literally suctioning. And then the Gemara explains afterwards, the Mishnah says already, and then we place the bandages to deal with the wound. Now, why is it, we get what the metzitza and the priya is, right, what the circumcision is, but what is the suctioning that they're referring there? So if you take a look, and it doesn't say explicitly in the Gemara, but it is clear throughout the generations that the tradition was, this is an oral suctioning of the penis by the moel. Why? For health purposes. The Gemara says it very explicitly. Why do we do this? Because of a sakana if the mohel doesn't do it. And goes so far to say, if a mohel doesn't do the oral suctioning, then what do we do to that mohel? We get rid of him. Why? Because it's dangerous not to do metzitza bepeh. So this is what the Talmud says. It's brought down the halacha and the halachic codes and the Shulchan Aruch throughout the generations. Now, take a look to the New York City Department of Health instructions in 2005. And they discuss the following. Circumcision has health benefits. That's a general statement. Recently, however, the department has documented several cases of herpes infection in newborns after circumcisions that included metzitza bepeh. Metzitza bepeh is performed by some moalim in the Jewish community. Some of these infants become seriously ill. One baby died, another suffered brain damage. Because there's no proven way to reduce the risk of herpes infection posed by metzitza bepeh, the health department recommends that infants being circumcised not undergo metzitza bepeh. What is the health department saying? Don't do this. Why? It's dangerous. Of course, the Gemara told us that it's dangerous not to do it. Now, this didn't just emerge in New York City in 2005. It already goes back actually to the 19th century. There's a number of incidents where boys were getting ill in Vienna, and they brought in an expert, a Gentile doctor, to examine it. He hears about circumcision. He says, okay, let me go see the circumcision. He sees the bris mila happening. He sees the metzitza. He runs over to the moel, open your mouth. Sees sores in his mouth and says, this is the source of the problem. Now, there's a whole debate amongst the 19th century poskim what to do about this. Interestingly enough, the chief rabbi of Vienna, Rabbi Eliezer Horowitz, turned to the Chatam Sofer, the famous Chatam Sofer, alleged forefather of ultra-Orthodox Judaism, said, what do I do? And the Chatam Sofer said, okay, the Gemara just says, do Metzitza. Doesn't say how to do it. So what should you do instead? Use a sponge, use a suction, right? Pipette, whatever it might be. There are other ways of doing this. And that's what he said to do. But in addition to these controversies in the 19th century, what else was going on about circumcision in 19th century Europe? The attempt to get rid of circumcision, right? From a reform movement to others and whatnot. And that led to a backlash, not only from the Orthodox rabbi to preserve circumcision, but to say that every element of the circumcision ritual, including metzitza bepeh, has to be preserved. But the Gemara says it's just for the sake of medicine. So they gave two responses. First of all, that was one reason the Gemara gave, but there are other reasons out there. How do they know there are other reasons out there? Because there are. Or two, it's Halacha L'Moshe MiSinai. It's a tradition as if it was given on Sinai. God couldn't have gone this wrong, and therefore you have to keep Metzitza B'Peh. And so this continues to be an ongoing fight in the Orthodox rabbinate in the 19th century and the 20th century. What do we do about Metzitza B'Peh? Many, many senior distinguished figures said, just do it an alternative way. Use a sponge, use a pipette, something, whatever it is. But do not do direct oral suctioning. This is just a bad idea now that we know about herpes and germs and whatnot. But others continue to do this practice. I'll tell you, I have the privilege of the blessing of having one son. About 10 minutes after my son was born, I called my parents, called my in-laws, right, got them in. Then I called the mohel. I was convinced that everyone else calls the mohel right away. It was the afternoon birth, and so I was nervous. I was going to lose the mohel I wanted, right, 8 days later. So I tell him, this baby, he says, when was the baby born? I said, about 12 minutes ago. He said, that is not the normal custom to call 12 minutes after the baby's delivered. But I said, I only want you as the mohel because I know you're a good mohel and you don't do metzitza b'peh. And he says, okay, you got me. You reserved me. But not everyone agrees with this, and there have been ongoing issues. There's a whole case in Toronto, there's a case in New York, there's a case in Yerushalayim. What to do about this? Now, many Orthodox poskim have understood that there's really no reason to continue doing metzitza b'peh. The Gemara tells us very clearly, why do we do it? For health reasons. And if now we know the science tells us that the health concerns go the opposite way, so stop doing it. This was the position of Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. This is the position of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. This is the position of Moshe Feinstein, the tshuva I gave here. And you'll see when this whole issue came out in 2005, the Rabbinical Council of America came out with a statement in which they said, don't do metzitza b'peh. It's interesting. They could have been a little bit stronger in my mind to say, you should not do metzitza b'peh. But what they came out and said was, we just think that it's not necessary. Yeah, something. I mean, part of the issue here is I don't think many people make the argument of saying like it must be that there's some true reason. There's a little bit you see that out there, but no, it's a little bit. I mean, listen, that's part of the issue here. Part of the underlying issue is how could the Gemara have gotten it wrong? Now, let me take a show of hands. Right? How many of you think, right, if you were in my position, you had a baby boy, whatever it is, how many of you would want direct metzitza b'peh at the bris of your child or grandchild or great-grandchild? That's what I thought. That's a good decision on your part. Okay? And I think many of us feel, when it comes to this issue, there's a certain sense of like, there's all these great rabbinic figures who've said use an alternative. And it's sort of obvious, like, that doesn't seem like a really smart thing to do, given what we know about science today. So let the halacha adjust accordingly. Okay, case number one. Yeah. Yeah. Sure, I mean, the notion of min agabatenu biadenu, that the you know, that the custom is in our hands, so to speak, and we follow it, I think has a lot of value in many cases. And like I said, in the case of fish and meat, right, you could argue there's no harm by us not having fish and meat. So But in this case, there's a compelling interest in the counter direction to say otherwise. So when there's a compelling interest to say otherwise, then you got to go otherwise. Okay, case number one. Now, case number two is dealing with the issue of the kashrut of fish. How many of you like eating fish? Good, right? It's good, it's healthy, right? All sorts of things. Don't follow the Gemara's advice about eating it when it smells bad, right? But it is a good thing to do. Eat. And by the way, fish has always been a very important part of the Jewish diet. Why? I'm sorry? Yeah, it doesn't have to be shechted. Right? You need a chicken, you need a cow, and that's complex. A fish, what do you need to do? Just catch it. I've gone fishing 4 or 5 times myself. I've never caught a fish in my life. But I am told that if you are more skilled at it, it is possible to be done. In fact, Myron, I think you took me as a kid fishing, and I was a terrible failure. In any case, and nothing's changed since then. Now they have fish farms, by the way. So you really just can't go wrong there, right? This is an advice. Now, so fish have always been important to the Jewish diet. And therefore, it should come as a certain, and by the way, particularly not just for generally, but when you travel, right? Traveling, right? Fish is very important. Now, take a look at the statement that was issued by the Star K in 2012. Star K, a very reputable, fine kosher organization in the United States. Until we issue policies and procedures for inspections, as we have for vegetables and fruit, the following species of fish, fresh, frozen, or canned, should not be used. This is a long list of fish, which are now being said, basically said, don't eat these. Red snapper, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a whole list here, right? People are very upset that they came to this year tonight now, right? Now, at the same time, while the Star K issued this ruling, the OU, the Orthodox Union, came out with a different ruling. OU Mashkichim, checking the gut cavities of sardines have in the past few months, discovered what appears to be a small white parasitic worms in and around the internal organs of some sardines. In the following tshuva, Rabbi Belsky Shlita, and one of the major poskim of the OU, concludes that these are the same aniscus worms which halacha permits. These worms have migrated from the flesh of the fish to its gut. What are we talking about here and what is going on? So take a look at page number one. How many of you have eaten dinner yet, by the way? See, I actually, this is the third time I've given this year. The first two times I gave this year, I was asked to speak before Kiddush on Shabbat morning. That is the worst speaking slot you can possibly get. And so basically I devised this year that I would just gross everyone out. No one would be thinking about Kiddush anymore, and it worked great. Okay, so in any case, take a look at page number two. This is a graphic here from the CDC. They did not do this graphic because of halachic considerations. Okay, this is not the New York Department of Health. This is the CDC warning people to make sure you cook your fish properly. Why? Because they explain. Look, chart number one here, right? Number one, marine mammals excrete eggs. The animals go into the water. The fish swarming larvae are ingested by crustaceans. The crustaceans are eaten by fish and squid. Fish and squid maintain larvae that are infective to humans and marine animals. And so what happens when you eat these fish? You can get sick. Why can you get sick? Right, because you're eating, right, these eggs, right, which have become, right, larvae, which became crustaceans, whatnot, which are very harmful to you. Worms and whatnot. And so what do the CDC tell you to do? When you're eating seafood, cook it. Cook it well, because otherwise you can get sick. Now, what is the problem when it comes to halacha on this issue? No, sushi, yeah. No, it's amazing, like in the certain circles of the Jewish world, sushi has become like the essential Jewish food. So if you question the kashrut of sushi, it's like saying, you know, gefilte fish is like, you know, I don't know, whatever it is, right? This has nothing to do with sushi per se. This has to do with, not allowed to eat. I'm sorry? Well, it's not like tray fish here. No, the raw fish can be kosher. What's the problem? Worms. Yeah, not allowed to eat worms. And so what's the problem? You open these fish, and what do you find? Can of worms. No pun intended. Actually, pun intended, I admit I did. Okay, thank you. Now, why would you then say, if that's the case, that these are allowed? It should be obvious, in fact, that this should be prohibited. So this is based on a Talmudic passage in the Gemara in Chulin, which tells us the following about worms in fish. Worms found in the meaty part between the skin and the flesh are forbidden, but those found in the fish in itself, right, in the outer part, are permitted. Why? Why would you say that the worms found in one part are permitted, but in the internal guts, the stomach part, are forbidden? So the Gemara doesn't say explicitly, but it was understood throughout the generations that this is an issue of spontaneous generation. That the worms found in certain parts of the flesh of the fish are spontaneous generated. And the Gemara has a general exclusion of all animals which are created through spontaneous generation, that those are not prohibited. What is spontaneous generation? Ah, right. So spontaneous generation is a long held. Yes, something along, I wouldn't say yesh b'yayin, but it is a long held belief in the way that certain insects or animals would be produced, right? Which we now know since Pasteur's days, but even beforehand, is just false. It's just incorrect. It just doesn't work that way. In fact, it's not only an issue with regard to fish, worms and fish, it also comes up with lice. Are you allowed to kill a louse or lice on Shabbat? The Gemara says, normally not allowed to kill bugs or animals, but on Shabbat, can you kill lice? Yes. Why? Because it was created through spontaneous generation. The prohibition of killing or wounding on Shabbat doesn't apply to creatures when there's a case of spontaneous generation. Now, I don't know how many of you have had the pleasure of raising children in Israel, but you will know that the issue of lice is not a small issue. This is not like a once-in-your-childhood experience, to say the least. So, are you allowed to kill lice in your kid's hair on Shabbat? According to the Gemara, yes. Why? It's created through spontaneous generation. Do you have to worry about all these worms which are being found, right, in the flesh of the fish? Well, according to the Gemara, no. But once you accept the fact that spontaneous generation is just simply false, then, seemingly, the answer is, well, this is a real problem. Go back to that list of fish. So all you anti-Matzitza B'Peh people, how do you feel about science and halacha now? Oh, yeah, oh, that's a real issue. Now, the OU has been very strongly insisting this is not a problem. So where does this come from? So it turns out in the 19th century, even before Pasteur, there's already understanding that maybe this whole spontaneous generation thing isn't true. And there was a disagreement, right, the rabbinic world, right, 18th century already and whatnot, about what do we do about this issue of spontaneous generation. So there's an encyclopedia called the Pachad Yitzchak from the 18th century who brings down a discussion of this issue. One position is given by Rav Yehuda Brill, who says we are not to depart from that which has been ruled in our Talmud, even if all the spirit of a human investigation in the world were to blow our way, for the spirit of God speak within us. The knowledge of the researcher is lacking, and his intellect does not reach the depth of the wisdom of nature. The wise men of the nations of the world do not nor understand nature, other than the superficial matters that are visible to the eye. Namely, what's he saying? These scientists, I don't know what they're talking about. We follow God. To which the contrast was said, what are you talking about? Right? If the sages of Israel were to hear the proofs of the nations of the world, meaning contemporary scientists, obviously they would say, right, that this isn't true. And what's the example they give? You know what we used to believe? That the sun revolved around the earth. Now what do we know? It's not true. So what do we say? Because Chazal think that the sun revolves around the earth, we have to believe that as well? So obviously, it is forbidden today to kill lice on Shabbat. Because the science is wrong, then the halacha has to change. And therefore, my friends, all of your fish, which you love so much, should also be prohibited. So how then does the OU get around this issue? So one response could be, well, sometimes we believe in spontaneous generation. Reed, you're laughing too hard there. But you could say, sometimes we believe in spontaneous generation. That is a position that's out there. Another position, and this is what Rav Belsky said, and Rav Belsky was very, very adamant on this issue. He said, listen, the Masorah, the tradition is to say, right, that these worms are not prohibited. Ah, the CDC tells us exactly where they're coming from. And moreover, we see them also in the cavity of the stomach. So we know they were ingested. So what's his answer? It must be they came from the flesh of the fish into the stomach's cavity. It's into the stomach. But he's insistent upon this. That has to be correct. Now, there is a different approach and answer to this issue, which I think is one which one could take, which is basically to say, I know spontaneous generation is false, but just because that's true, the assumptions under the halacha are no longer true, it doesn't mean the halacha has to change. So if you take a look in the writings of Rav Herzog, for example, middle of page number 3, Rav Herzog here is discussing again the issue of the louse and lice, and he says, listen, I get it. Science doesn't believe in spontaneous generation. Although modern science, as far as I know, does not acknowledge the existence of a spontaneous generation, for halachic purposes, we have nothing other than the words of the sages. Meaning, he's basically saying a formulation of what in other halachic terms might be called batal atam eno batal agzera. That means to say, even though the underlying rationale of the law is no longer true, the halacha doesn't change. A similar idea was taken by Rav Moshe Glazner, the Dor Ravi, and others who basically said, listen, the law was canonized. Now, I think there's a logic to that. You can make such a claim and say, listen, even though the underlying rationale of the dispensation isn't there anymore, nonetheless, law works with its own logic. What's the problem, though, if you take such an approach? What do you now respond to the people who are insisting? What do you say to them? What are they basically saying? I gave this lecture before in Skokie, Illinois. So there's a well-known pediatric epidemiologist who was very active in the fight against Matzitsa Bepeh. He was also a fish lover. So I said to him, Ben, what are you going to do? He said, I'm done with the fish. To his credit. Now let me give you a third case, which I think is particularly sensitive and interesting. And this again here relates to what is obviously outdated science. It's not, again, not Chazal's fault, right? They're just using the ideas of the time period, right? And that relates to the issue of paternity testing through blood, and we'll see momentarily DNA tests. Now how do paternity tests work? Okay, so today when we do paternity tests, usually people do what? DNA. You can do these kits at home. We'll get to that momentarily. In my mind, highly not recommended. Well, you're going to see why I say this momentarily. But sometimes there are neat reasons why people need to establish identity or rule out identity through blood type. So how does it work? So there's a segment here. I just gave it here from nature.com, but you can see it in all sorts of places. In cases of questioned paternity. What are cases of questioned paternity? Right, try to figure out who the father is, right? I remember once I was came to visit my hometown of Houston. Outside the airport, there's a sign, 1-800-DNA-TEST. Who's the father? Call 1-800-DNA-TEST, which is a bad sign of what's going on in society as a whole. But there are times when this needs to be done. So how can you use blood to rule out man being a child's father. So they explain, a man who has type AB blood could not father a child with type O blood because he would pass on either the A or the B to all of his offspring. Right? Meaning, if there's AB, I gave you a little chart here on the fourth page here. You can rule men out if the child's blood type is an A, right? So the father's blood type must be, right, one of the, right? You see the chart here. Right, so this is what's called negative paternity test. Okay? It's the idea which says that, well, we know that blood type comes from the father and the mother. Okay? And if we see that the father is one blood type and it doesn't match up with the kid, we can rule out that he's the father. Okay? It comes up all the time. There are all sorts of famous cases with this. Houdini had an interesting case with this. And there's all sorts of interesting history to what's known as negative paternity test. Blood doesn't work as well to prove someone is the father, but it works fairly obviously to rule someone out as the father. Now, why is this a contradiction to halacha? You might say, listen, what do we know of blood tests? Because the Gemara Nida tells us that there are three partners in human beings. God, his father, and his mother. Okay, the father supplies the substance out of which are formed the child's bones, the sinews, the nails, and the brain. And his mother supplies the substance out of which is formed his blood. So the Gemara is telling us that where do you get your blood from? Now, the Gemara didn't know about A, B, and O, whatever this or that, but that's what they believed. And by the way, it has halachic implications on this issue. So there's a very interesting case. I want to get so into this right now. What happens if the offspring of a couple are constantly having health issues from circumcision? It happens, right? So after a certain point, by the third kid, we say, don't do the mila anymore. Right? It's a bad idea. Now, there's a whole discussion in the Gemara and then brought down the Shulchan Aruch. Do we care about whether it's the same mother or the same father, right, nerds? You can have, right, how many times does it have to be the same two parents in order to establish this chazakah or not? And the Rambam brings down a position which basically says, well, we just really care about the mother because that's where the blood comes from. So this idea has finds its way into halacha. It's not just an agadita. It has halachic implications. What's the problem? Is that true? So when the issue of negative paternity test emerges, what are the posts I'm going to say? Does this work? A simple case. Yerusha. Okay. Inheritance. Okay. Well, it matters whether the person is a father or not. So Rav Uziel, first Sfarik chief rabbi of Israel, basically said the following. I don't care what the scientists say. Chazal say it's from the God, father, and the mother, and the mother brings us the blood. And his counterpart at the time, Rav Herzog, let's remember who's the Rav Herzog that we just saw previously. Right? Rav Herzog says to him, right, I'm embarrassed by what you wrote in such a deprecating manner towards blood tests from a negative aspect. That is, with regard to the possibility that blood test can clarify that X is not the son of Y. How can there be a question of the credibility of the doctors in a matter which has been clearly accepted by all the masters of medicine throughout the entire world? Our sages nowhere say that was a statement handed down to Moses on Sinai that creatures came to existence by spontaneous generation, right? Here comes the spontaneous generation thing. And then he goes on to say, it is unfortunate that while science is progressively conquering worlds and discovering all sorts of secrets, although two errors at times, we, like ostriches, bury our heads in the sand. Wait a minute. Didn't Rav Herzog just tell us, with regard to the spontaneous generation, well, we know it's not true, but halacha doesn't change. But in any case, here, he's very insistent. You got to believe it. Why? What's going on here? Now, you tell me, right, when do we like paternity tests and when do we not like paternity tests? So I'll give you the following case. And this isn't just about blood. It relates to all sorts of issues which Chazal didn't know about, like DNA. So the following case came up, and I think it was Shari Tzedek Hospital, if I'm not mistaken, in which there was confusion in the maternity ward over whose baby belonged to who. And this doesn't regularly happen, Baruch Hashem, right? But it can happen. And so they went to Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, and they said to them, you know, we have an idea of how to solve this problem. What are we going to do? DNA. Right? We can solve this problem today. Right? Change things, right? This is an old issue, but we have ways of solving this. And they said to them, well, how does this DNA work? And they explained to them. They said, well, how accurate is it? They said, oh, it's very accurate. They said, okay, use it. Right? Makes perfect sense. Now, let me give you another case. 9/11, there are 8 agunot, potential agunot, from the Twin Towers. Now, in 7 of the cases, we had other evidence that they were in the building at the time. They called from there. There's all sorts of stories here. In one case, we knew nothing about the location of the husband except that he had bought a train ticket. The Grand Central Station, was that 42nd Street, whatever it is. And that's all we know. There's no definitive evidence that he had made it, gone to the Twin Towers that day. And so the question became was, well, what do you do with regard to the Aguna situation here? Because there are stories and cases where people have disappeared and they're quite well alive and used the opportunity to leave. There's a case in Argentina in the Buenos Aires bombing, and there are other cases along the way. Now, 6 months later, a body part was found, and they did DNA testing, and they identified the husband. Now, would you use the DNA test to matir the Aguna? How many of you use the DNA test to matir the Aguna? How many of you would say, we're going to use the clear science here in order to say that this woman, the husband has died and this woman is no longer guna? All of you would do that. Now, let me give you another case which comes up, thankfully, more often than airplanes going to the Twin Towers. A couple having a dispute, getting divorced, alimony payments. And at some point, the husband says to the bed then, I don't think these kids are actually mine. Alas, it happens more often than we'd like to know. And the bet then said, why? He says, I believe X, Y, and Z. And they said, okay, we've got DNA. Let's use it. All you love DNA for the changeling case, right? And all you love the tamatir, the aguna. So they do the DNA test, and they find that the first child is his, and the second child is not. Now, alimony aside, what have you just created? A mamzer, a bastard child. Serious, serious implications. How many of you like science now? And so when Rav Uziel said, I don't care about the negative blood, I mean, what was the point of the negative blood test? The negative blood test was there to rule out that the father could be the... And so what was Rav Uziel saying then? Why did Rav Uziel not want to use negative blood tests? It wasn't just because it went against the idea in Chazal. It's that he understood that the implications of this could be remarkable. And remarkable in a very scary way. And then he basically said is, well then, don't use the signs. But now let's figure out how to do this. We use DNA testing for all sorts of things. So let's go with Yerusha. Would you use DNA testing for Yerusha? Why not? Yeah, makes sense. It's fair. Would you then use DNA test for the Mamzerut? It's either one or the other, right? Seemingly it's one or the other. So here's a wonderful psak from Rav Vosner of Karlitz, major poskim in Bnei Brak, who basically say the following. When it comes to Yerusha, we use DNA testing. When it comes to Mamzerim, absolutely not. Absolutely not. It's the same thing. It's the same science. What's their answer? No. Yerusha, we care about clarifying the truth. In Mamzerut, we only follow the rules as given by Chazal. Rav Mordechai Willig was a well-known posek in New York, wrote a tshuva on the Agunot situation in the Twin Towers. And he basically said, listen, we're going to use DNA testing. Ah, we're going to use DNA testing to matir aguna, but what's going to be the problem? We'll create mamzerim. So initially states, maybe that's just the way it is, right? Truth is truth. The science tells us the truth. Halacha has to go with that. And then he says, well, wait a minute. Maybe not. What does DNA evidence tell us? What does DNA evidence tell us? It tells us that this father, right, the husband, is not the father of this child. Does the DNA evidence tell us that there is an affair? No. How did the child get born? It says, who has children these days the old-fashioned way? What do we do today? With IVF, artificial insemination. So DNA doesn't tell you anything about an affair. Brilliant. But what's the obvious question? Well, just ask them. What is IVF done here? And what's his answer? Don't ask. Don't ask. Why not? Because we don't care about the truth? Or it's not that we don't believe in caring about the truth. It's that we understand that while there are scientific truths out there, which we know to be true, there are certain moral or ethical truths which trump over it. And therefore, when it comes to thinking about halacha, it's not just about what's true according to the biologist. It also comes down to what's true according to some form of larger vision of what we want the world to look like. Do we want to clarify who the changeling is? Yes. Do we want to matir the aguna? Yes. Do we want to create mamzerim? No. Ah, the science is inaccurate, it's inconsistent. Okay, sometimes we're inconsistent in life. Not because we don't know what's scientifically true, but because we believe that halacha is governed not only by those principles, but also by ethical truths. So now let's think to our case examples together now. We could say we're just going to follow science throughout. Now, if you get that, what do? You get rid of Metzitza Bepeh. You stop treating your kids for lice on Shabbat. And you stop eating the fish. And you use DNA or blood test. And whatever comes out, comes out. Option number one. Option number two is to say, no, we just follow what Chazal said. Metzitza Bepeh. Use some Listerine beforehand, hope for the best. The fish, we gotta love our fish though. And when it comes to the DNA evidence or a blood test, we don't know of it. Not so appealing either. Or option number three, which in one form or another is taken by many poskim, I think in a very admirable way, is to say, well, it just sort of depends. It depends not because we want to deny the scientific truth, but rather because we also want to take into account a ethical or moral truth, which is also a part of the halachic tradition. And so, to conclude, and I ask myself on this issue, how do I feel about outdated science in halacha? And the answer is that it's not just a matter of whether we accept science to be true or not. I think most of us in the room, when something's well established when it comes to science, affirm that to be true. We rely on the doctors for those purposes, and we rely on the biologists for those purposes as well. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the halacha changes with it. And then it depends on the situation. Then, of course, the obvious question is, well, how do you decide which case is which? And the answer to that question, and I'll end with this thought, is that there is no scientific formula for telling you us how to paskin, how to rule on the halacha on these cases. All right, and there are going to be many, many other cases that emerge on this issue. And there's a certain amount of sensitivity that comes to this issue, which is not easy to determine how we're going to answer from ahead of time. But it's my hope and prayer that as more and more we understand, our greater knowledge and understanding of science continues to develop, that our halacha will also develop in a way which takes into account the tradition, takes into account the scientific truth, but also takes into other elements of truth or moral truths that are central to the halachic process. Thank you. Yeah. I love that. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, you see, it depends how recently you've been dealing with lice in your house. Oh, lice you can deal with. I understand. Well, yes, you are right, meaning I agree with you that there is a compelling moral consideration in the first and the third cases that's stronger, in my mind, than the fish case. But keep in mind, increasing the accessibility of kosher food, not just for people traveling, but for dietary reasons, for financial reasons, for other reasons, is a really important value. And so I agree with you that there, you know, it's not as compelling, right? We can find other fish to deal with, but there are many people when they looked at this list, and see like, wow, I really need these fish. You know, not because they like this a favorite restaurant, it's because it's part of their diet. So I think that you can make an argument. And in that respect, I actually have admiration for Rabbi Belsky at the OU to basically saying, where this is mutter. I mean, kosher organizations around the world, it's one of the great accomplishments in the last 100 years of making kosher food accessible to the masses. And he was very adamant that we're not going to retreat on this issue. Yeah. So it's interesting you mention that because he was asking if the halacha would change, if fish would be found to be not so healthy. Maybe that should also impact the halacha as well. So particularly from fish farms, is referring to. So by the way, it's interesting that we don't have the meniscus worm problems from fish farms. Why? Because it's a controlled environment, right? It's not the CDC's environment. Right now, you are right that I mean it's an interesting question, right? Would you know if it became a health issue, right? Would you say I haven't seen maybe you know might know better than others that fish are more harmful to our health than a big fatty you know hamburger, but if it gets to that point, okay, we'll have to have other considerations. Sure, right? I agree with that. That's always a consideration. We haven't banned smoking. We've banned smoking. We've banned smoking. It's not true. Boskim have banned smoking. Right. I'll plug my book right now. You can read about that in my book. Not everyone keeps halacha the way they should. Okay. We've banned smoking. Right. 1976, the first... what do you say? Not just Yeshiva Bachrim. Many people don't keep it in their attics, and we have to help people get off of smoking. But smoking is also according to halacha. I'm not the first to say this, right? Said in 1976, of Chaim David Levy said it, 1982, of Rabbi Elias of Waldenberg, and many poskim have said it since. Yeah? About whether it proves it? So let me talk about DNA for a moment here. I have a very good friend who runs, what's it, one of these DNA testing boxes. What's it called? Not the 23-1. They're competitors. There are many, many companies right now that are selling you DNA kits. Why are they selling you this? Oh, no. People are interested in their heritage. You might be familiar with a politician in America who got herself in all sorts of trouble recently over this issue, right? But the many people are interested in finding out their heritage and to find out where they came from and whatnot. And you know what? For the rest of the world, go for it. For us, that's a terrible, terrible, terrible idea. I'll tell you why. Because, you know, not the choshesh b'ksherim, as they say. I don't think this is a widespread problem. But sometimes DNA tests reveal things that we really, really don't want to know. And there's a whole Facebook group, you should know, a very large Facebook support group for people who discovered through home DNA test kits, right, that their children aren't their children. It's like a whole, you know, don't search online, but take my word for it, right? It's a whole phenomenon about it. Now, having said that, let me tell you another issue of DNA. As you know, there are 350 to 400,000 Israelis who are fully integrated into Israeli society. Jewish culturally entirely, halachically not Jewish. According to Orthodox halacha, most of whom come from the former Soviet Union. So not far from here, the Eretz Chem de Kol has come up with a solution to the problem. There's something called mitochondrial DNA, and one goes through the mother, and they basically say, use these tests, and if we can prove that people have Jewish heritage, we can make them Jewish. It's a brilliant idea. The only problem is, you can't accept the DNA in one way and not accept it in the Mamzerim case, unless you can. Right? So there's a lot at stake in the DNA issue here. And again, I'm very much in favor of selectively using it. Now, I'll put it one way. You know, it's not that I can't handle the truth. Right? I'm not Colonel Jessup or Lieutenant Weinberger, for those of you who know your movies. Right? It's that I believe that there are certain types of truths which outweigh the scientific truth. Oh, thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you as well. Okay.
Now, my point, my question, and actually my comment, I don't think it's science versus philosophy.
Yeah. 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 I fully subscribe to that, agree to that, but it doesn't, meaning, don't try this at home, kids, right? In other words, if the DNA test, you've done a DNA test, give a dramatic example, right? You know, But let's be smart about how we deal with this issue, right? Don't try this at home, kids. That said, I think moving it up a level, the dilemma that's facing halacha, as determined by decisors of halacha, is very real. And there, I do think there is a question of how far we're going to go in accepting scientific, what's known to be contemporary scientific belief, when it goes against the assumptions that were behind ancient halachot. I don't think there's any way of getting around that. And so there's a broader philosophical question that's at stake here, which is not the same type of question as the evolution question, right? Because evolution, I think, fundamentally comes down to, I mean, there are a lot of implications, but is fundamentally a theological question at its core. There are other implications of that, of course. This relates to law. Law has its own logic to it in every system, not just halacha. But you have to be very thoughtful and careful about how to think about these issues. Yeah, but as soon as you say they're not black and white because they're evolving, what does that naturally lead to saying? People are going to disagree about this, how to deal with this issue. Yeah, I fully agree with everything you're saying, your qualms about it, but this is a real, I think, a real dilemma here. The question that the base is, well, you know, what really should be relevant here is what's the origin or status of this law, right? That impacts the severity of the law. I agree with that. If you're interested in this topic about the impact of the thing, you're welcome to read my dissertation, all 460 pages, including all the footnotes, because it is related to this. But for now, I'm not going to answer your question. No, it is true that it is clear, right, that there's a difference between minhag, right, and flexibility here. One of the answers that some people gave in matzitza is the law. How to do the matzitza is a minhag. The only thing is that minhag has a very strong role, and sometimes we see it to be quite binding. And by the way, that's not just Jews. Like, you know, anyone here from England, right? The common law, right? Custom for centuries is quite significant, right? So it's not always so easy to make that distinction. But I agree that there is room to do that. But, you know, you might and sometimes, though. Right, so what are you doing right now, though? Right, you're trying to find a way to make those distinctions based on the law, which is a good idea. But just think, right, you have to be careful what the end result is. And then you might sometimes want to say, that custom is really strong. And other times, that's not just a strong takana. I'm with you, I agree.
There's a way of maintaining consistency.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure you can make and take consistency. I'll give you a very simple example. When it comes to what's considered to be a trefa, nevela, there are 18 different signs for how do we know an animal was ill. And therefore, when they do the shechita, right, we know that if you see one of these signs that the animal has this, that means that it would have died within a year, and therefore it's not kosher. What if, which is the case today, that we know that there are other signs where sometimes an animal could have a certain wound or illness, but it wasn't known by Chazal, it wasn't in Halacha, but it's not one of the 18. There's a whole literature on this issue. A whole literature on this issue about this issue, as it'll have implications in other realms, areas as well. No, don't read my citation. I'm saying I think that's a good distinction, but it doesn't always work out so easily. Yeah, last question, and I'll stick around afterwards. Right, so that's part of the, I mean, one of the arguments in that case is, you know, maybe this is a great solution. Right? There are people that get nervous about it, partly because they say, well, what if I don't have that DNA? Does that mean... So one of the issues you're raising here raised a broader question of, well, if we don't always fully know what the implications of the signs are going to be, right, and how they implicate in all sorts of different areas of law, then maybe we shouldn't use it. Right? That's part of what the argument against the Eretz Chemda is, like, we don't know where this is going, with Kohanim, with Yuchsin, all sorts of things. But there's a good argument to follow what Eretz Chemda is suggesting for the very simple reason. There are 400,000 Israelis who are not halachically Jewish, according, who are going to marry my children and your children, your grandchildren. And now what are you going to do about it? And then, so this is going to be a major issue about how to use DNA in this case, and I agree with you. You have to think about how to apply it. And whether we can selectively apply different types of DNA is going to be an interesting question. Thank you all very much. Great to have you here.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.